Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. And everyone goes, I know, we know the drill, you record on Monday morning. So we're still in the middle of Women's History Month. So let me share a quick story. So a good friend of mine who I actually knew from the 1970s, he went to Carleton, I went to St. Olaf, and now he lives in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He's a very, very successful business person. And he said to me, so guess what I'm doing this weekend? I said, what? He said, I'm going to Gloria Steinem's 89th birthday party. And I went, are you kidding me? He said, no. I said, I have a story about Gloria Steinem. He said, no. I said, I do. I said, when I was running for governor, Gloria Steinem and Lieutenant Governor Murphy, Evelyn Murphy, held a fundraiser at L.D. Acheson's house in Massachusetts to raise money for me as I was basically getting ready to hopefully, and I did, win my primary. And there's a picture of me standing on the chair, and here is Gloria up at my kneecaps, and here is Evelyn Murphy on the other side by my kneecaps. And I kept thinking, who am I? Look at these women, and I'm the one standing on the chair. It's just remarkable. Because of that conversation, I'm going to just share with you a little bit about the remarkable Gloria Steinem. Her paternal grandmother, Pauline Perlmutter Steinem, was chairwoman of the Educational Committee of the National Women's Suffrage Association, a delegate to the 1908 International Council of Women, and the first woman to be elected to the Toledo Board of Education. She graduated, no surprise, Phi Beta Kappa from Smith College in 56, spent 2 years in India on a Chester Bowles Fellowship. In 68, she helped to found the New York Magazine, where she was a political columnist and wrote feature articles. As a freelance writer, she was published in Esquire, New York Times, women's magazines. She co-founded Ms. in 72, remained one of its editors for 15 years, and continued to serve as a consulting editor. I can share with you all the names of her books, but this is where my connection is so intimate. Steinem helped to found the Women's Action Alliance and the National Women's Political Caucus. She co-founded the Women's Media Center in 2004, and she was president and co-founder of Voters for Choice that merged with Planned Parenthood Action Fund in 2004. I could just go on and on and on, but I do need to let you know that I remember when the National Women's Political Caucus picked me as one of the candidates they wanted to follow and support. After I lost my race in 1992, everyone, they picked two women to fly down to Washington, a winner woman and a loser woman. And I represented the loser woman. And by the time I got done finishing my speech, we were all crying together. It was really, I needed that cathartic moment because I reminded them that some of us get to open doors, but others eventually get to walk through them. And that was my job, was to give them a door to walk through. So with that, let me share with you who's on with me next. So I have been following CVB. I've been following New Republic. I am like still angry at Barney Frank, and I probably always will be. As a result of this, and we also interview on a number of occasions, Robert Hockett. Robert Hockett writes for Forbes magazine. He is a professor of law and public policy, and he's just incredibly informative when it comes to the issues of banking. So I was sort of looking through a number of articles, and I saw this. What's actually behind the banking crisis? Why you pay when they pay? Or as I put it after reading the article, the financialization of everything. It was written by Lynn Paramore. She's a senior research analyst at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. She is a cultural theorist, I love that concept, who studies the intersection of culture and economics. She's contributing editor at Alternet, where she received the Bill Moyers Schumann Foundation Fellowship of Journalism in 2012. She's also a frequent contributor to Reuters, Al Jazeera, Salon, Huffington Post, and other outlets. I could go on, but I think maybe one of the things is that you co-edited a key documentary book on the Occupy movement called The 99%, How the Occupy Movement is Changing America. And what you need to know, Ms. Paramore, is that I actually made bumper stickers that we sold to raise money for my radio station. And what did the bumper sticker say? I would be rather occupying Wall Street. That's what it said. I'm here, but I'd rather be there. So let me welcome you to the program. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. And we're very fortunate to have Gloria Steinem, and we're also very fortunate to have you. So thank you very much for what you do.
You wrote an interesting article because it's a Q&A. I want people to know who you decided to call when you were trying to figure out what exactly is going on here. What's the history of this? What is happening at this moment? And then more importantly, what do we need to sort of assume or hope for that might begin to sort of fix it? So it really is sort of the three faces of Eve, as they say.
Yes, of course.
So tell me how you picked Walker Todd.
Walker Todd is an expert in both law and economics, which makes him an interesting person to consult. He also had quite a long history in the Federal Reserve System. He was assistant counsel of the New York Federal Reserve. He was also at the Cleveland Fed. So he's been actively involved in financial regulation for decades. He's also taught finance at Middle Tennessee University. So he's a really good person to consult, particularly on matters of history. He's got a great mind for history and is someone who studies the intersection of culture and economics. I'm always interested in the historical backdrop and the cultural changes that pertain to some of the events that we're seeing. So he was somebody I really wanted to call up, and he was very generous with his time and did exactly as I had hoped and really gave an important historical backdrop to what's happening with the banking crisis and discussing things that you're not really seeing so much in the mainstream headlines. What you referred to as the financialization of everything is a problem he really homes in on as something that has led up to this banking crisis. And he is very adamant that we will continue to see banking crisis. You know, we might get out of this one, but we'll see another one. And they tend to get worse and worse if we don't somehow deal with this financialization problem.
So one of the lines I love in your piece was you said you turned to Todd about how serious this crisis looks to him and why it came to be that banks are allowed to play casino games that wreak such havoc. And again, yeah, that's what I want people to understand. When you had the image of the banker historically, and most people still have that image, even though it's long gone. It disappeared a long time ago. You might still have it in a mutual bank. You might have it a little bit in a community bank, but that's not where most of the money is. You know that. It's in these huge regional banks or the four big ones, all right? And so I think people have this idea about the safety and soundness and the fiduciary relationship you have with your banker, and that your banker knows you and you know your banker, and they make all these sort of informed decisions. And in a way, I understand this story because it's personal to me, because my brother went to work for Manny Hanny, Manufacturers Hanover Trust, and then it got bought up by somebody else, and then it got bought up by somebody else. And by the time my brother, who was just going to be this sort of normal little routine banker, he became a vulture capitalist. Let me just tell you that. Yeah. So his trajectory really parallels the story that you're telling
in
the piece, because I watched him not necessarily, how do I say, he changed, but he changed as the institution changed. And you watched him morph, and you watched his relationship to money and clients change. And as I'm reading this, I'm going, oh my God, we're just preparing for the next crisis. We keep thinking that we've begun to resolve it, but we weaken the regulations, we create a loophole. And I think it's really important. So start with a little bit of the history that he told, because I think it's really important for people to understand these seeds were planted a while ago.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about the perception that the public has of banking. You know, if you were a little girl growing up in the 50s or the 60s or even the 70s, somebody might tell you, oh, you want to marry a banker because they're very steady and reliable. You know, it's a safe occupation. And things really changed. And they changed in the 1980s, as so many things did. So we go back to the 1980s, and we've got a character named Walter Wriston over at Citibank, the head of Citibank. And he is gung-ho to make Citibank the number one, you know, hub for finance. And he begins to put pressure on, and gets a lot of support for this from his fellow bankers, put pressure on Washington to repeal Glass-Steagall. And the reason that he wanted Glass-Steagall repealed is that he wanted commercial banks to be able to get back into investment banking, which they had been barred from since 1933. Glass-Steagall was put in place during the Great Depression to, you know, put a regulatory system in place that would keep these risky financial activities that banks had gotten up to from causing such havoc. But unfortunately, under the Clinton administration, Clinton signed off to repeal Glass-Steagall, and the banks were off to the races. And what happened was,
let me just say one more thing, because not only, I mean, I followed the Clinton years, obviously, because it was too intimate to me. So not only does he repeal Glass-Steagall, but just before he leaves office, he deregulates derivatives. Yeah. And when you look at the derivative market was relatively small before the deregulation. By the time they had deregulated, you look at it, so most of the investments were under no regulation because they all became derivatives. I mean, it was just so disgusting. And it happened so late in his time in office. And I think a lot of people always look at Glass-Steagall, but I think in some ways what warped the system even more was to add icing on the cake with the deregulation of derivatives.
Yeah. And so we ended up with a mess that, you know, Todd went through various financial crises that we had up until the biggie in 2008. In 2001, you really got financialization cranking up. You got mortgage-backed securities during the housing boom, the real estate boom. And everybody thought, oh, this is great. You know, the value of these things is going to go up forever. And that really worked out well for everybody until they didn't. And we all know the result of that in 2008. So, you know, what you basically have starting in the 1980s is you've opened the door for corporate executives to really focus their attention, not from boring, safe banking at, you know, banking activities, but using customer deposits to play casino games, you know, and using things like these derivatives to do it. So they're chasing short-term profits through risky activities. And as they found out in the 2008 crisis, when they screw up, well, guess what? They get a bailout. And that's at the heart of a lot of the conversation that is happening and should be happening right now with the most recent bank collapses. You know, we have to do bailouts in a sense to prevent contagion through the rest of the system. But if those bailouts don't come with really strict rules and regulatory oversight, then something that's known as moral hazard is created, in which, you know, you have to ask yourself, why would a bank, somebody running a bank, do anything safely when risky activity is so profitable in lining their own pockets and they know they're going to get a bailout if they mess up? It creates a contradiction and a paradox at the heart of banking that makes things dangerous. And until we address that, we're going to continue to see these destabilizing events.
So Lynn, there's a couple of things here. And that is that, so I've been, again, I mentioned I talked to Robert Hockett. And so there are a couple of suggestions as to what to do. What we do know about SVB and the Signature Bank is that they basically covered all the deposits. So even though there was a $250,000 limit, and as I keep saying, you know, when you go to your bank teller, it actually says it right next to the teller. It goes, please understand that FDIC will only cover us up to $250,000. Well, I read it, you read it, but 90% of the depositors, obviously, at SVB did not read it because 90% of the deposits were over $250,000. So they obviously thought the rules were for the little people, but not for them. All right, whatever reason. There are two things I'm kind of curious about. And that is that what they did with SVB, they did not do in 2008. And that is that while they protected depositors with SVB, they did not protect the shareholders. They did not protect management. Now, what happened in 2008 is, guess what? That was like the opposite. They protected management. I mean, they were able to, yes, they paid it back, but look at who they protected on the way to being paid back. So I think there was a bit of a lesson learned from 2008.
Yes.
Although there was some, you know, even though there was Dodd-Frank, that was actually, everybody needs to know how watered down Dodd-Frank was when it passed. Original Dodd-Frank and what you got was like a complete shadow of itself. And then in 2018, they deregulated even more. And my two senators, Maggie Hassan and Jeanne Shaheen, were some of the 17 Democrats that voted for that sort of deregulation. And now we see what happens. But here's the frustrating thing about everything. You can put teeth into something, you can have a regulation, but the regulators have to regulate.
The regulators have to regulate.
In your article is that they knew in 2018 that there was a risk with SVB. They saw how many of their deposits were in excess of $250,000. And that should have just set off every alarm system known to man. But for whatever reason, no one at the Fed did anything. Members of Congress either ignored it or didn't know. And you can't be shocked by what happened. Because as you point out, when you look at how they sort of quote unquote protected themselves, it was assuming interest rates would never go up. And we've never seen interest rates go up so quickly. And guess what? The whole bottom fell out.
Yeah. And that is a really, really important point to keep in mind. you know, people are throwing up their hands and saying, oh, how could this have happened? Well, we know how it could have happened, because as you point out, in 2018, President Trump signed a bill rolling back the Dodd-Frank legislation, which was already, you know, it had some serious flaws to begin with. And what happened was you begin to get these banks taking on uninsured deposits, which couldn't be covered if the bank failed. And yes, the Financial Stability Oversight Council made a list of mid-sized banks that could pose a systemic risk. And their list showed that Silicon Valley Bank had over 90% of its deposits uninsured. And guess what? First Republic Bank had 67% uninsured. And that's compared to maybe 40% on average, which is already pretty high. So they knew, I mean, they had this information clearly at hand and they didn't do anything. And I said to Walker Todd, you know, that is a pretty big failure of our regulators. And he pointed out, yes, and in the political context, it looks like it was mandated by Congress. Even if they'd said no to the banks, even if the Fed had said no to the banks, you know, they would have just gone to Congress and spread enough money around to put pressure on them to get the changes they wanted. That was the political climate. And when the political climate is very bank friendly, this is what happens. So no, the regulators were asleep on the job, or willful blindness, ignoring this problem. And guess what? You know, it metastasized. Big surprise.
Okay. So I want to know if there's a fix. And you talked about moral hazard. I mean, part of this, everyone, is also driven by the fact that we have grotesque inequality. And so when you begin to deal with the grotesque inequality, that's even the backdrop. Okay, let's take a look at that. And then what we look at is after the 2008 economic meltdown, one of the ways that we solved it was we made these enormous banks. So we didn't solve it by spreading the risk, by diversifying the portfolio. We just kept adding to the sort of these four large major institutions. And the problem is, what are they? They're too big to fail. So all of a sudden you have a situation now, for example, with SVP or New Republic or whatever, Signature Bank, and everyone thinks, oh, just the flight to safety is to the big banks. No, that's not. That's the worst thing you want to do. When you realize what you really need to do is be able to sort of not only diversify the portfolio, but there is a raison d'etre for a local community bank. There's a reason for a regional bank. You don't want it all in the four big banks. We know what happens with monopolies, and the consumer is never served because the consumer is incidental to how they make their money. So what does he recommend that we do, again, wanting to avoid the moral hazard, but at the same time recognizing that we have to send a message, and one that has more of a long-term effect, because we are going to need to depend on these financial institutions, especially if we're looking at reindustrialization, especially if we're looking at the climate crisis. We're going to need an infusion of dollars in ways that we haven't sort of seen before, but I want to trust that infusion.
Yeah. Well, you know, and it's interesting to point out, we're doing the exact same thing with consolidation of banks right now. You know, look at Switzerland. They've got one bank now. So guess what happens if that bank gets into trouble? There's nobody else to buy it up. So that is a very serious situation. All these smaller banks are getting gobbled up by bigger banks, and people are pulling their money out of smaller banks, getting worried and putting them into bigger banks, thinking that they're going to be safe there. But these bigger banks pose even more of a danger to the financial system, the bigger they get. So that's a tremendous problem. Also, if the banks tighten their loans, you know, if that activity slows, it has a ripple effect on the entire economy. It has domino effects for hiring, for spending, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a really serious problem that we're by no means out of the woods on. And in terms of what to do about it, it's a really tricky question, because at the heart of all this, if you really boil it down, you've got the problem of money in politics and the tremendous influence that these banking executives have over Congress, over Washington, with their political donations. And that is a really, really tough thing to get around. Now, can we get the financialization genie back in the bottle now that it's out? Well, Walker Todd pointed out, we did it in the 1930s, in the 1940s. We had a succession of laws passed that reined in the activity of banks and put them under a regulatory framework that made sense and protected the citizens of this country. But until we go back to Glass-Steagall, until we reinstate it, there's no way that we're going to contain this activity. It's just too profitable. The profits that are made give these executives too much power over the political system. So really a return to Glass-Steagall is what he recommends. You know, either that or a kind of plan where you'd have 100% reserves at banks. And you know, that, of course, we don't have the political will to do. So it's a really difficult thing. I mean, I think at the very least, proposals to put really stringent rules on any bank that gets a bailout are essential, because the public is already angry about this, as well they should be. You know, we want to see the clawbacks of all these bonuses that were handed out at banks like SVB before they failed. We want to see executive compensation looked at. We want to see what the taxpayer gets in return for these bailouts. I mean, Walker Todd pointed out, we pay for it one way or another. Anybody who says that the taxpayer doesn't pay for this is full of it. We pay for it in many, many ways. You know, you're liable to see interesting, mysterious little fees popping up at your bank. You know, I remember after the 2008 financial crisis, I banked at HSBC, and suddenly they said, you know what? It'll take 2 days longer for an out-of-state check to register in your bank account than it used to. Gee, why is that?
They can hold on to the money.
Exactly. So they could float it and earn the interest on that money. That was pure and simple. And you'll see things like that, some of them even more hidden, so you won't even know. There will be money that, you know, taxpayers will have to pay up every year. I know it might be a small amount, $200, $300, but that adds up to billions of dollars for the entire country. So we're going to pay for it. And as I said, the ripple effects in the whole economy. We're all going to pay for.
We've been using an expression, the financialization of everything. Mm-hmm. Can you define for my audience what that means? Because I think I know what it means and you know what it means, but I don't think they understand what they financialized. I mean,
it's
really important, because this wasn't true historically, but guess what? If you're going to make more money, you're going to figure out, well, I'm not going to have to sit in my bank. What can I do with it? And that's really where we're going. So can you describe in like a few minutes what that means?
Absolutely. Financialization is kind of an ugly abstract word, and it's good to break it down. So it's basically when you start treating everything like it could be a bank liability, and that's auto loans, credit card loans, anything. Todd was joking with me that he and his securities lawyer used to speculate they could securitize the air rights in New York, which, I mean, I'm sure people have actually thought about that. So, you know, banks are using deposits to play these casino games, basically using your money to go out and get into all these risky activities. And then when the risky activities blow up in their face, you're in danger of losing your money. And the only way to fix that is to get a sudden bailout. Suddenly everybody is wanting a bailout. So that's what happens. And it's really, it's just separating the source of funding for the consumer's deposit, from the reality.
So what I'm hearing from you, and what I understood as I read your article, which is a fabulous article that Lynn Paramore wrote, is that the financialization of everything is, historically, banks would say, okay, I loan you money for a house and I'm going to put it into my portfolio. I loan you money for a car. So I know you, I know the car, I know the house. But then they decided that why keep it? Why not sort of put it out there on the market? And they put it in tranches and they divided it up and they started selling these things, you know, to people outside of the bank. So the problem is whoever bought it didn't know you, didn't know the house, didn't know the car loan. And so what's happening is that you got greater separation between the person that actually loaned you something, where historically you would have created a relationship and a sense of location and purpose and geography, but that wasn't going to make them as much money as if they could sell it and they could try. So, I mean, that's the part that is so freaky to me, is that everything they came in, they looked at and said, how can we get rid of it and sell it for more? It was, and that was historically not how banks, I think, operated and how people thought that their banks operated.
No, you're using, you know, deposit money to gamble on things that you don't know anything about. In the case of the mortgage-backed securities, you know, these may be attached to properties in another state and you've never seen them. You never heard anything about them. You don't know anybody you can ask about them. I mean, it's just blind gambling. And, and again, things can and do frequently go wrong with these kinds of activities.
And it's hard for people to acknowledge the mistake, because the mistake was so protected by billions of dollars. I mean, so it's really not a mistake, because your banker will call you up and say, oh, that's really not the problem. Here's what we could have done. You know, or you find out that SVB was on the Federal Reserve of San Francisco. I mean, again, there was connections.
Yeah.
So they're like octopus. I'm seeing the octopus behind you, but their arms are sort of like, you know, everywhere. But it's not just an arm. It's an arm attached to money. Okay,
yes.
Remember that, everyone, and that makes a difference. And I'm going to have to let you go, Lynn, but yeah. As I'm reading your article, again, it's entitled What's Actually Behind the Banking Crisis? Why You Pay When They Play. It's at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. I just share a story because, again, it has become so normalized, even though we didn't understand it, but within certain institutions, within the business community, became normalized as financialization of everything. We renamed, I've told this story a million times, we renamed our business school at the University of New Hampshire from the Whittemore School to the Peter T. Paul School of, you know, Economics. And what is Peter T. Paul? He's known as the father of liar loans. So we named our business school, everyone, after the father of liar loans. He came up with the idea. He was able to duplicate it. Everybody jumped on it. You know, he managed to somehow bail out before the 2008 economic meltdown, but he made a freaking fortune before he did, donated to the school, and they renamed the business school after the father of liar loans. That's just to let you know, this is like, it's everywhere. It's
well, look, I live in New York City, and right outside my window, you can see the Citi biking system. They're underwritten by Citibank. So they're called Citi bikes, C-I-T-I. You know, the very bank that we've been referencing as at the heart of the problems that started in the 80s. So there you go.
All right. Lynn Paramore, again, she writes to the Institute for New Economic Thinking. I'm going to recommend that you go to my Facebook page or go there and click What's Actually Behind the Banking Crisis, Why You Pay When They Play. Thank you so much for doing this, Lynn. I really appreciate
pleasure.
It.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure to be with you.
Great. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will be right back. Stick around.
There was another mass shooting in Tennessee yesterday. These mass shootings in the United States are now a regular part of our national life and have been for a long time. And there is a partisan disagreement about this. The Democratic Party, generally speaking, believes that we need to regulate gun ownership in one way or another to save people's lives. And the Republican Party, which is, of course, deeply intertwined with the MAGA cult, worship at the altar of the gun. And that is barely an exaggeration. This is a political party whose members wear little lapel pins with, I believe it's an AR-15, on the floor of Congress. This is a party where many members, many elected officials send out, for example, holiday cards with their whole family holding powerful weapons. Why? Because in their view, liberals want to take their guns away, and therefore they are going to worship at this altar, even if that means again and again and again the loss of innocent American lives, losses that could easily be prevented by rational gun laws like so many other countries have. The Mitchell Minute is a brief and hard-hitting daily comment about political events from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear the Mitchell Minute every day, you can subscribe on my YouTube channel at Mitchell.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels
feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Monday morning. So I go to the Washington Monthly all the time. We have Paul Glastris on the air with us a lot. And I saw this article, Marjorie Taylor Greene is winning. She's got an enormous megaphone, which obviously is essential. So Margaret Carlson is the author of this piece. She is a columnist for the Daily Beast. She was formerly the first woman columnist at Time Magazine, a columnist at Bloomberg View, a weekly panelist on CNN's Capital Gang, and the managing editor at, well, let me see what it is, the managing editor. Where were you the managing editor? At New Republic. Okay. And so you wrote this piece about MTG. And I have to tell you, Margaret, I'm reading it and every line is like, oh my God, I got to tweet that. Oh my God, I got to Facebook that. Oh my God, I got to do this. It's so sad because not only is it so funny, but it is so damn accurate about MTG. And I think we kind of know about her because we saw her as toxic waste just 2 years ago.
It's come on shore.
Yeah, it's come on shore. It's come on shore. So let's talk a little bit about your article. And as you write, you know, she's got an enormous megaphone. She's on these now essential committees. She has Kevin McCarthy in her debt. I mean, what more could she want? And I think you kind of mentioned it in your article. What she wants is she looks in the mirror and goes, mirror, mirror on the wall. Who's the next president of them all? And she really is, I think, looking at herself, not just as a potential VP for Donald Trump, if he should win the nomination, but she truly is looking at herself as the future of the Republican Party and as their eventual nominee. And that beyond belief, that is so terrifying, but so predictable.
To update you, you know, yesterday, Trump nominated her for the Senate.
Yes,
in this wacko Waco speech, which is, as far as I've ever seen him gone into crazy world. But she's sitting there and he nominates her for the Senate. I think all the women whose names end with I, Nikki, Christy, Carrie, are going to have to move over for Marjorie Taylor Greene. Because if Trump were to get the nomination, oh, God forbid, I don't even want to say those words. I think he would pick Marjorie Taylor Greene. She is so hot in that world, next only to him. So no. I think that's possible. Why Marjorie Taylor Greene is worth a whole column is that Marjorie Taylor Greene is Kevin McCarthy and Kevin McCarthy is Marjorie Taylor Greene. He has power, so not as much as most speakers because he's a weak speaker, but he still has power. And he's so grateful to Marjorie Taylor Greene for dragging him across the finish line that he's promised her the world. There's nothing she's done since then that's alarmed him, caused him to speak out. Nothing. No one can think of one thing where he has gone against her. And she keeps escalating. She's in favor of secession, calling it a national divorce. And by the way, I'm all for it. I'll take my blue state and go away. And then you can pay the taxes that you don't pay for the services that I don't get because I'm paying your taxes.
Yeah, but then Marjorie Taylor Greene's going to be homeless because how do you define Georgia? Do you find Georgia by their two U.S. senators? Or do you find, where is she going to go? I mean, she's going to have a split screen for Marjorie Taylor Greene because I'm not sure in which direction Georgia will turn.
She doesn't deal with that. Like, where's Austin going?
Yeah.
Austin, Texas. You think it's going to stay there? You know, I think Abbott's going to, I don't know. It is preposterous. Would you think we would be here where, you know, we have Trump fatigue? And I think we have it way too soon because he is getting more unhinged. And guess what? For me, watching this speech yesterday, his followers are going with him.
Yes.
The energy is there. There's no other energy in the Republican Party. And it's only because they only have that energy because the Republican leaders are giving it to him. After January 6th, they all had the moment when they could have said, this is too far. We are not letting Trump rule our party. He is no longer the titular head, and we are abandoning him. Not in so many words. They could have done it in many different ways, and that's not the most eloquent. But they all came back, every single one of them. The only one that you could give any credit is Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell has been silent, but he has not broken with Trump. But he is the most further from Trump in the leadership.
As we have seen, the sophistication of gerrymandering to the point where they actually divide the marriage bed. If the Republican is a male and the Democrat is a female, they'd figure out how to sort of divide the bed in order to make sure that it was perfectly gerrymandered and partisan gerrymandered. So one of the reasons why I think the Republicans could not stand up to Donald Trump is that Donald Trump has the megaphone of Fox News. He has the megaphone of Christian radio. He has the megaphone of commercial radio. And on top of that, when you recognize who shows up in a primary, they don't care about a November election, Margaret. You know that, and I know that. They are terrified by their own base. They are terrified by them because so few people participate in primaries anyway. And the only ones that do are rabid. I mean, they're foaming at the mouth. And Donald Trump is feeding them over and over again with his, you know, with his grief and anger. And I think that's part of the problem is, yes, they were horrified by January 6th. And for maybe 48 hours, they actually realized this is crazy. And yet what's to them more frightening is not to win. And they would sacrifice crazy and say, well, that's how it's going to be in order to win. And the person that assures them the win, sadly, is that madman at Waco. And we saw the madman, but his madness is infectious, Margaret.
Well, it infects that crowd. And did you notice how he finished the speech in some ways? At least those of us who've heard speeches would see it as a closing. But he winds up into another whole spiel where he's freelancing. And just, you know, meandering down Pacific Coast Highway has no sense of what he's saying. And then it's full grievance. There's nothing but his grievances. It's like the Irish who only remember their grudges. And by the way, he doesn't have that much to feel a grudge about, given all he's done. He's gotten off so easy. My favorite part of yesterday was he's blaming Michael Cohen for going to jail for trying to save Donald Trump. Donald Trump said, Michael Cohen just felt like doing it. He just felt like paying that money to Stormy Daniels. One other frivolous thing I will say is that he invited another defamation suit yesterday, which he got from E. Jean Carroll. Jean Carroll had nothing to really go against. You know, she kept losing and didn't have a court date until she sued him for defamation because he said she's not his type.
Right.
He said that more or less about Stormy Daniels yesterday. Now, too bad Michael Avenatti's in prison because he'd jump all over this. But I would think Stormy Daniels is a very, shall we say, lively woman. And I don't know. I mean, when she comes on camera, she's almost Trump's match. She just doesn't take any guff. He doesn't even have a sense of his own self-interest at times. You know, calling people animal and scum, you'd think that would get to people. But back to your point. Yes, the MAGA mob that you know, where they now have a choir at the D.C. jail. And Marjorie Taylor Greene went there on Friday and then goes to this rally and Trump plays that. How did we get from, I would say there was agreement on about 85% of the country that January 6th was a mob trying to take over the Capitol. Now, gradually, polls showed that what was the mob has gone to, quote, legitimate protest. That question, when that's asked, it's now considered a legitimate protest. There's this gradual thing where instead of being on the defense, the MAGA people are on offense about January 6th. Would you have ever predicted? I thought for a while they wanted to tamp it down and not talk about it. Now it's a flag they're waving.
Well, it's the effectiveness of propaganda. I mean, that's what this is. This is a form of, this is propaganda. If you hear a lie so many times, eventually it becomes your truth. And they only, I mean, they're in silos. They only watch Fox, or they only, you know, read whatever the paper is that they're reading, the New York Post. This information, this storyline is repeated and repeated and repeated. The script is identical, whether you're in Iowa, whether you're in Florida, or whether you're in Texas. I mean, the words are the same, Margaret. That's the thing that's so shocking. They're all working off the same script. The script is then echoed, you know, in social media. The script is then echoed on Fox News. Eventually, you forget what you saw. You forget what you thought, because maybe that was the aberration, because now this is real for you. And you have a wonderful line in your piece, which I just thought was just incredible. You were talking about, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene, where was she, you know, 2 years ago? Where is she today? And you write, 2 years later, you write, who displays a poster when you've moved from, she had a, I guess she had a poster on the front of her office about gays or LGBTQ. And of course, the woman across the hall from her happened to have a child who was, you know, transgender, and she was doing this basically to flip the bird and to do emotional harm. And you write, 2 years later, who displays a poster when you've moved from the cheap seats to the speaker's chair? We've arrived at the point where Green could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose McCarthy. Who's turned gratitude into a vice? Semi-delirious after he eked out victory close to 2 a.m. back in January, he gave Green a bear hug and posed for a selfie with what could have been a tear in his eye. To the press, California Kevin gushed from the ironclad bond he'd formed with a North Georgia congresswoman during their time in a foxhole. He told a friend, listen to this, everyone, I will never leave that woman. I will always take care of her. And I'm thinking, as I'm reading this, Margaret, who's taking care of whom?
I don't think I had a husband who said that. And I also wanted to make the point that, you know, in Hollywood, they say you have to have sincerity. And once you fake that, everything else is easy. Well, my fear is that in politics, you fake sincerity. You don't have it.
Yes.
When you're dealing with somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene, and McCarthy seemed to mean it. I'm flabbergasted, because in politics, you get what you want from a person and you move on. I don't admire it. I wish, you know, we played on a different field, but that's how it works pretty much. But I think he does feel inner debt, because that near death experience, if you saw the hunted look in his eye, oh my God. So now we have the highest ranking officials in Washington are Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy. And Kevin McCarthy has a noodle for a spine. And Marjorie Taylor Greene is boiling the water, to try to carry that metaphor through. Or, you know, she's pulling the strings. But I still have this notion that if they'd all gotten together, they could have done something right after January 6th. We were all, it was like 9/11. Everyone was just appalled and frightened and scared. Didn't think Trump would go that far. Didn't think he could have people going that far. They attacked the place where they live and work, the Capitol building. I mean, it's like we're now kind of inured to it, aren't we? I mean, we've seen the tape so many times, but still, it's frightening. You'd think our elected leaders would have stood up. Are they never going to stand up for anything?
Yeah, but Margaret, let me just say something.
Anyway,
you went back to 9/11. Let me remind you, after 9/11, I thought this would be a moment of where we would step back and look at ourselves. So what we were told to do by the Bush administration, go shopping. So you're surprised that the Republicans didn't rally, that they didn't come together and go, this is outrageous. This is assault on democracy. Oh my God, what happened? I had no expectation of them doing that, because they're incredibly coward. Again, the goal is not about governing. The goal is not about protecting democracy. The goal is about winning. And Donald Trump proves that over and over again. Winning at any cost. There is nothing to be protected but the win.
Well, then there's another reason, Arnie. They're not going to win with Trump. They didn't, and they're not going to. The best opponent, if Biden runs, for him to have is Trump. Not a fresh face in the Republican Party, not a younger face in the Republican Party. You know, all the pieces now are that DeSantis, you know, he's falling a bit. He was going to be the go-to. But I think anybody in a general, and they must know this. They must know this. We know this. It's not just polls. We saw it in 22. They're not going to win with him. Look at him yesterday. They must know. He's now, I'm not going to make historical comparisons because I'll get a lot of hate mail, but he's a madman all to see. Fox doesn't cover all of Trump's speech. It precisely, I think, actually to help him. That's where they are. Think about it. They used to cover, beginning to end of his speeches. They don't do that anymore. Now, maybe because he was a candidate. Now he's a candidate. They covered it when he was a candidate the first time. Because I was out there. I was amazed that I could go back to my hotel room and Fox would be playing the whole thing again. They couldn't get enough of it. So that they're not means, maybe the Dominion voting systems lawsuit is getting to them. But maybe it's Trump's madness that's getting to them, because Fox likes to win, too. As we know from the depositions, they like to win. And the reason that they're in the hot water they're in is that they still thought Trump was a winner in 2016 or no, excuse me, 2020. His ratings weren't, his appeal to their audience hadn't gone down. Appeal has gone down a bit. The appeal has gone down a bit.
So let me just say something. I think you and I are under the old impression of winning. And winning in politics means getting the title, congressman, governor. For Donald Trump, that's not, he has no admiration for the process. For him, winning is destroying something. And I think what he is seeing is that his legacy is what he will have destroyed. And I think that's what is just so terrifying for you. You really see a win as, well, he wants to be president again. He wants to sweep in the Republicans again. He doesn't give a crap about them. He doesn't care about anything. What he's figuring out is, what is my legacy and what did I destroy? I mean, winning for him is, if he doesn't end up in jail, he will have won. He will have won.
He will have won. But Republicans will not have won. There's going to come a moment when they're going to see that Trump winning, he's not just going to destroy every enemy he has. He's going to destroy the Republican Party.
Yes, yes.
Now, when do they see that? When do they see that? I see it. I mean, I know the rational, Trump's irrational, so he doesn't care what he has to do to win. And boy, I mean, I have never seen in public life, certainly, even in my own life, I have never seen such visceral hatred of the system that has him not as president and, relegated to Truth Social. Did you see it? I'd be frightened to be in the room with that person.
Here's the part that's so frightening. I understand that the Republicans that still see themselves as elected Republicans or work at the RNC or whatever, they understand that he will be the cause of their loss. They get it. But they have never, ever taken the time to explain it to the base. They've never taken the time to talk about what the choice is. They've never taken the time to describe the policies he refuses to talk about. So the problem is that he will be successful. He will destroy the GOP. You had a wonderful line at the end of your piece. I actually reproduced it. It's a Woody Allen line, and you write it as it captures McCarthy's angst. It captures the Republican Party's angst. Let's be honest here. And you write, Woody Allen captured McCarthy's angst in his fictional speech to graduates standing at a crossroads. Now listen to this, everyone. I love you, Margaret. Quote, "One path leads to despair and utter hopelessness," he declared. "The other to total extinction. Let us pray we have the wisdom to choose correctly." Amen, you write. Margaret, that is the choice. There is the choice is this black hole. There is no way to go to get out. And they have created the fact that there is no crossroads because they've destroyed the whole thing. The gestalt is toxic.
Well, you can see yesterday that there's nobody, a leader, I mean, somebody with some heart to them, some soul to them, some charisma, could have explained what you just said, what the party's about, what it should be about, what it's lost, what it could gain if they move on. But there is no one like that. I don't picture that person. I had some hope for a governor, you know, Charlie Baker of Massachusetts, Chris Sununu in New Hampshire. I had some hope. Baker, I'm sure, is not going to run. He's too grounded to get into that melee. And Chris Sununu now is kind of vacillating on how he feels about Trump. So
he's a coward.
There's no one.
Yeah,
I know. But why not run and lose? But why not go out there and try to change some minds? You know, there's a piece in The Atlantic about evangelicals and how they sold themselves out, but they could be pulled back. The reason they're evangelicals is that they believe in something bigger than themselves, a morality. They have a code. They gave it up to win, but they must feel somewhere in their soul. That this is not right. Now, I probably am hyperventilating today because I'm just immersed in that speech at Waco, which I think is just another descent in, you know, beyond what I'd seen before. Really, I was having dinner with my daughter is going away, and I mean, she's married. It's not like she, you know. She's going away. Anyway, I'm like, I couldn't really be myself. I was just too taken with what had just happened.
You're shocked at the level and the depth of the vitriol and the anger and the hatred and his crowd is reveling in that. That's their food. That's their air they breathe. That's their sustenance. That's why Waco was the backdrop. That's why Waco was the backdrop. He is able to then take all that grievance and basically say, I am your savior. And there's a lot of grievance to go around. He has no solution for grievance, but he knows how to play grievance. And that's what you saw on steroids in Waco. You saw that on steroids. And I think the problem then becomes, it just reinforces itself. And Donald Trump knows nobody will cut a check to Ron DeSantis. Nobody will cut a check to Greg Abbott. Nobody will cut a check to any of those Republicans because they are terrified. What if it turns out that Trump becomes the nominee, which it looks like at this point he will then take out his revenge on them, and he will personalize it, he will monetize it, he will put it into law, into regulation. They are terrified of him as well. And as a result, they're sitting on their hands. Where I used to think that the multimillionaires could eventually, you know, pick their candidate, they can't because they're so afraid of Trump too.
You know, I thought Trump won the first time because he hated the people that the working class hates, the elites, so-called elites. But I thought there would be a limit to how much hatred what our normal people, like my plumber, could go along with. And now I'm that fervent group, which doesn't include my plumber. It shows they'll go along with a lot more than I ever thought they could. And that's happened, that additional hatred has happened because he lost and because of Alvin Bragg and what else is coming down the pike. And it looks like they're willing, it's having the opposite effect of what I think it would have in a normal world. In a normal world, he's the mob and you're afraid of the mob and you're on the side of the DA. You're not on the side of the killers. They are, because power is everything. Power, there's nothing to a certain nugget of that group. Only power matters, and only getting back matters.
And you have to
remember, revenge is what matters.
But you mentioned the article about the evangelicals. You have to remember too that we're talking about now white Christian nationalism. We're talking, and I use the word Christian nationalism. The operative word is Christian, not white, not nationalism. So they've now been able to package a lot of this angst and hatred and vindictiveness with this idea that somehow it's Christian. I mean, it sounds like an oxymoron. It sounds like the opposite. But, you know, you almost see Donald Trump with a cross behind him. You know, that somehow he's on the cross for them. And that is, I will never forget this, and I got to let you go, Margaret, but I was at the 2004 Republican National Convention. It was like, you know, the first one after 9/11. And my girlfriend screams at me. She says, you got to come down and see the podiums. Okay, remember, this is 2004. And I'm looking at three podiums. And the three podiums that were set up for the Republican convention were made of wood. But you know what was interesting? In the center of each of the wood inlays were crosses. Were crosses. Mm. She said, look at this, Marty. And I went, oh my God. And she said, this is what they're about. That was 2004. And now they have embraced him. They may be, they may even try to be pushing back, but he's delivered too much for them and he has become their sinner. And that unfortunately is the sinner that delivers is better than the sort of, you know, is better than the Jimmy Carter who does the walk, but doesn't deliver what they claim they want. It's shocking. It's shocking.
Oh, that's true. That is a good way to put it. Yes. They don't want a Jimmy Carter.
Exactly. I keep thinking about Carter, who is supposedly, at least on paper, everything, every Christ-like thing you could imagine. But that's his flaw and not his asset. Washington Monthly printed a fabulous piece, very funny, very acerbic, very on point, by Margaret Carlson. It's entitled, Marjorie Taylor Greene is Winning. She's got an enormous megaphone, essential committees, and Kevin McCarthy in her debt. I thought you were going to write in her pocketbook. What more could she want? Thank you so much for doing this. And I love how you write. So thank you and keep writing.
Bye. Thanks, Arnie.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie, artist and producers Dave Scott, Stephanie Collins. We'll schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao. You better-